Michigan's Upper Peninsula is my home and Escanaba is my hometown. I'm Craig Warple. Hometown Escanaba connects with the people, activities, and newsmakers of Escanaba and the UP. Join us for more interviews at hometownescanaba.com. Now, let's find out what's going on. Joining us this morning is Lauren Wickman, Delta County Prosecutor. Appreciate you coming in this morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much. We have been hearing a lot about the red flag laws that have now gone into effect here in Michigan.
Correct. They went into effect yesterday, the 13th.
So that's going to be concerning for a lot of people who own guns. And one of them is that people can be turned into law enforcement for no apparent reason.
It I think, is a lot more complex than that. There does have to be a reason. It's actually a felony to put false information on that application, to have the extreme risk protection order be issued if it's found out that you
lied. So it can't be used as a retaliatory
situation. If they find out somebody's lied or falsified information that's gone towards that, that is actually a felony. So there's pretty stiff consequences for trying to use it, I believe. That was what they were trying to eliminate, is the retaliatory, the enhancing, the making up of information to try to make it look like this person really should have their guns removed.
Obviously, it's to eliminate a lot of the violence that's been going on around the country. But the concern is that they can be taken without due process.
There is a due process to it.
Beforehand?
Not beforehand, necessarily. And I know that's one of the big sticking points. It puts a big onus on law enforcement. And I know they're struggling with it just because it's all new. And when we have all these new things, there's very little structure to provide to law enforcement. There's some structure that was provided to the judges that are going to have to make the decision. Our office doesn't have a ton of involvement on the front end. We're not involved in the application process. We're not involved in the actual granting of the order. Our involvement comes down the road if there's ever a violation of that order. But there's a lot that's left to be figured out, and I think a lot of that's going to take some court cases moving forward and making an appellate process, going up to the Supreme Court, figuring out what you can and cannot do. There's a lot of concerning language I have with the statutes, just because I think it leaves a lot open to interpretation, and that's usually not a good thing for a statute.
Such as? Not to pin you down.
There's just some, the court can order an anticipatory search warrant. So if they're anticipating that the individual won't voluntarily turn over or surrender their firearms to go through that due process, the court can actually order a search warrant to allow for law enforcement to go take those firearms. And there was something about it that changed the standard of that search warrant in just a very concerning way. And I can't remember the exact phrasing off the top of my head, but it lowered it, from my reading, it lowered it from a probable cause standpoint, which is what we have to use in a criminal case for a search warrant. And it's a pretty solid standard that's used across the board, and so it would concern me if it's indeed a lower standard to grant that anticipatory search warrant.
The law then just requires law enforcement, if they get a complaint, to knock on the door and go, "I need your guns."
Well, no, there's an application process. Basically, either the individual or law enforcement can go seek that application to the court. The court then grants it, they can grant it ex parte, they can grant it with a hearing. So there could be some due process.
So they would know ahead of time whether or not this is a effort after them.
The individual could know ahead of time. They might not, and it might be that they get a copy of the order from the court through the sheriff's or through law enforcement, and at that point they might have to turn over their firearms, and if they don't, then they can go the search warrant route.
Has there ever been a situation in your time here in Delta County that you would have said this would have been a good idea for?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. I'm sure there was one where maybe there was a level of concern that could have risen to that. Thankfully, nothing came of it, obviously, where the firearms were used. So I can't think of a specific case that I would think this would be the perfect opportunity to use it, or the perfect example of when it should be used.
Luckily, we've not had an egregious situation.
Absolutely.
Such as the shooting downstate where the parents then were charged.
Right, absolutely.
Which is a new thing, and I don't know if you have any opinion on that, because it's kind of along the same subject here. It's not the red flag laws, but certainly holding people accountable for gun violence.
And I think it's a very interesting precedent for a couple of different reasons. That, I think, was the perfect case. And I think the fact that the mother was tried first was a very good decision by the prosecutors down there. It seemed like the evidence for mom was much more significant. Obviously, the evidence against dad is yet to come out. He hasn't gone through his trial. But I think it's a very interesting precedent. I think there should be some responsibility and some accountability held on parents when there are so many warning signs. And I think that's what the trial showed, was that the parents had a lot of warning signs to see that their kid was screaming for help, essentially. And he was not heard, was not heard, was not heard, and took that drastic and tragic actions.
Okay. So how do we move forward as a prosecutor then with these red flag laws?
Right now, my role is just assisting law enforcement as they come across with any questions. Obviously, that I'm aware of, nobody came in on the 13th and tried to file an application okay. right away. I'll be real curious to see how the courts move forward with it, because obviously the judges will have their own opinions and their own criteria that they're going to look at. They're given a standard and they're given advice from mm-hmm. the Supreme Court on how to handle them, but everybody obviously makes their own decisions. So I'll be really interested to see how the courts handle them.
Do you think it's based on actions that they've done or actions they could do?
It's kind of both. So they have
that's got to be the hard decision.
Correct.
You're sitting there going, this is what they could do.
Right. So they have to show.
How do you make that decision?
The person has a pattern, and that could be that they have a pattern of assaultive history. It could be that they have, you know, some level of stalking history. That's not exactly the right word, but some mm-hmm. level of a pattern of concerning behavior. And this is what the concern that this person has. They have these firearms, and they think they could use them in X way. And that it does require a fair amount of, I guess, leap to see that they could go from action A, B, and C all the way to what they could do in the future. So it'll be very interesting to see how it sorts itself out with the courts in that regard.
Law enforcement can file an application as well?
They can file an application if they believe that, based on either an investigation they're doing or perhaps they have
encounters with them
concern.
On some other
Correct.
Issues.
And so, again, it'll just be interesting to see what the courts decide to do, whether they take those on a different set of standards than an individual off the street. I guess only time will tell.
We do have our own issues once in a while here in the Upper Peninsula, for sure. Delta County, in January, there was a shooting that was obviously based on emotion.
Correct. We just conducted the prelim on that matter last week, and Judge Parks found that there was probable cause and bound over. So the individual is charged with one count of assault with intent to do great bodily harm, less than murder, based mm-hmm. off of a shooting incident that occurred at the end of January.
Are you able to talk a little bit more on how that happened?
I can't really go into a ton of detail, just because it is still an active pending case. We are likely on a trial track, so I'm sure there'll be plenty of things that are going to come out. But right now, it's going to slow down quite significantly. It always seems like on these types of cases, there's a lot of emotion, a lot of buildup to a prelim, because it usually happens within 2 or 3 weeks of the event occurring. And now with how our circuit court set up, it's going to be probably 2 or 3 months before we're back in the courtroom on it.
How's the victim?
The victim's doing well. He's doing very, very well considering his injury. So he's recovering well and was released from the hospital only a couple days afterwards.
Okay. And the shooting was where? It was in
Flat Rock, Cornell area.
Yeah, okay. Yep. One of the things that you also wanted to talk about was Dave Moyle, who I talked with yesterday. I wish I'd have known that I could have asked him some questions on this. But he has for months tried to figure out how to remove people from the county meetings
right.
in order to gain control of the meetings, because there's quite a few in the audience that are there to voice their opinion on
Correct.
Different things. So it happened again in the last meeting.
It did.
Where he tried to remove somebody, or at least threatened to.
Correct.
And he mentioned that he had both the support of the sheriff and the prosecutor. You tend to be the prosecutor, so this is your opportunity to talk about that.
And it's one of those things that I can't remember exactly how Commissioner Moyle phrased it. I believe it was in his commissioner concerns. And I've had extensive conversations with both Commissioner Moyle as well as the sheriff on the policy that's currently in place, and I've expressed it publicly that I think there's some pretty significant concerns with how it's formulated. This conversation with the three of us essentially goes back several months, and at one point I had proposed an alternative option that I felt was much stronger for the county to be able to control the meetings. But also, should there be anything that comes about of it, if somebody is ultimately removed, it gives the county much stronger standing to have and to fall back on. And nothing at this point has been done with it, but the policy as is, I have concerns with. And so when it was phrased that, I think it was that he met with the sheriff and myself and then went on to that this was passed, it certainly implied to me that he had my support for it. And I don't, with how it's currently phrased, I don't think it's appropriate. And I obviously have expressed that at previous meetings. I don't want to put the words in the sheriff's mouth, but we have talked about our concerns related to how it's phrased and the actions. And quite frankly, how it puts some onus again back on law enforcement is one of my major concerns for it, to have to remove a public person from a public meeting.
At what point, I guess I don't, but just in case, at what point would it come to a level that there needs to be something
done? So the policy I propose is one based on a couple different policies that I found from municipalities downstate, counties downstate, that look like they've been a bit more tried and true, put through the ringer, so to speak. And there's a process. There's a multi-step process with multiple warnings. And then at some point, there's almost a due process in the meeting portion of it, where the individual can get up and speak, and the individuals on the board can speak. And there's a vote on it, and it comes to that point. And it's just... it's much stronger. There's a much stronger, I guess, framework for how to go about. And so there's a better record should there be anything that comes about.
Because our society does need to be based on civility.
It does have to be based on civility. And there's been instances where I know Commissioner Moyle thinks, and I know the room, the acoustics in there, and we've talked about how to maybe change around the acoustics, because up front you can hear things that you can't hear in the back, but... the public perception is that nothing's being said and all of a sudden somebody's getting yelled at or told to be quiet. And I've been to enough of the meetings where I couldn't have pinpointed the person that it was being directed at and standing in the back. So the civility absolutely needs to be there. I think the public comments, both on the front end and the back end, are a huge portion of that. But there's sometimes those things get emotional. And I think that has to come with the territory to a certain extent. And clapping and laughing or what have you kind of comes with that setup, that public setup as it is. So,
absolutely. Last Friday, my sister was called to jury duty.
Okay.
And she didn't get called up front at all. It was in district court, so I don't know if you were the prosecutor. I asked if she knew who you were, and she didn't. But it was interesting listening to her. Now, I've been called several times as well.
Sure.
I've always gotten chosen up there, but always got booted. Okay. But kind of give us an idea what you look for when you're choosing a jury.
It very much depends on the case. We usually have a list that we get very minimal information about the individual, name, job, occupation, sort of thing. And we go through that, and sometimes I look at it with, this is, you know, an assaultive crime, this is a drug-related crime, and try to look at it from that perspective. Ultimately, I just have to go with what I think is best. I try to always look for somebody who's paying attention, who, while maybe this isn't the favorite place they want to be on that particular day, is willing to listen to everything that anybody might say, look at all the evidence. Because ultimately, if they go in with an open mind and open ears, they're going to be a good juror. It's at that point how the facts come into play and how those facts lay out. So individuals that don't want to be there, I've had people get up there and very clearly don't want to be there, aren't going to listen, just want to be out that door.
But that's unfair.
It is unfair. It is very unfair, and it's not something that I want to have around, but at the same time, it's not something that should be the case. Judge Economopoulos has a really good speech that he gives to everybody about how this is such a big honor. And it really is. It's something that our society could not move forward without this structure. And it's such a unique structure and system. And there's a lot of countries, obviously, that don't have that. And it's the way that our justice system is built that gives everybody, I think, the confidence that it's working and that the verdict was just, because it's not me making the decision, it's not the judge making the decision. It's 12 people that we could go out on the street and go up to and shake their hand and say, what do you think about the situation? And that's how it should be. They're the people who are going to be able to look at all those, boil it down to common sense. That's one of my common themes I always ask people. It always gets a laugh of, do you think you have good common sense? Because I've known people who would answer, no, I have terrible common sense to that. But I want somebody who's... has that common sense, that can look through some of the smoke and mirrors that comes along with a trial, the theatrics that come along with a trial, and really just get down to the nitty-gritty details of, did this happen, how it is being told to me.
Do you get a sense of how most people respond to jury duty when they're done?
I think most people, after they've sat through it, have actually really enjoyed the process. I've talked to several jurors after jury trials that, hey, this was really enlightening. It's not like it is on the TV.
Mm-hmm. Not a Perry Mason moment,
not Law and Order, but they really enjoyed it. They really enjoyed seeing it all come together, seeing it through to it, the end, the conclusion, and just generally thought it was a really good learning experience and not a terrible way to spend a day or two.
I think I would have a very hard time if I was on the jury to make the final decision.
Yeah, they give you a lot of instructions how to get you there, at least how to have the discussion.
Based on more than just emotion.
That's one of the instructions, is to try to leave emotion out of it. In some cases, that's a lot easier than others, but there's a good process in place, and I've never had somebody come back on a hung jury. We had a couple with questions, and that always comes about because there's some things that, for one reason or the other, the jury can't know or doesn't know, and those are always the hard ones, but coming through and coming out with an actual verdict is quite the process for a lot of the people in there, but it's a necessary process.
How often do you call juries a month, say? I know it probably varies month to month, but
yeah, I'd say we average about 2 to 3 a month. Unfortunately, I feel like there's still a lot of false starts, and by that I mean, like, we think we're going to have a jury trial on
Friday, and then
the Thursday.
My sister
beforehand.
Had one like that where she got called and then they were told that it had been settled.
So most of the ones, I think right now we have 2 circuit court trials going in March, 2 in April. I have 1 yet this month in circuit court in February. So about 2 or 3 a month, trickle in 2 or 3 district court ones in there.
Okay.
And every once in a while, probate jury trial.
Right.
So
those are not as often?
No, not as often. I'd say maybe 2 of those a year would be my rough estimate on probate jury trials.
All right. All you have to do is register to vote, and you too can be called to jury
duty. Absolutely.
Lauren Wickman is our Delta County prosecutor. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. A special thanks to our sponsor, SwedishPimple.com. Check out all of the fishing lures made right here in the Upper Peninsula at SwedishPimple.com. You can continue to follow us at HometownEscanaba.com. We connect with the people, activities, and newsmakers from Escanaba and Michigan's Upper Peninsula.